Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, Aaron. It's fantastic to have you on the podcast today. We know you as someone who really drives innovation, but with a real focus on technology and bringing together kind of a technology and business strategy. But maybe before we dive into all things kind of innovation, you could give our listeners a quick intro.
Great. Thanks for having me on. So like you said, I've spent most of my career sort of in the technology and engineering space, companies ranging from a 10-person startup all the way through companies at the scale of Amazon. I got my MBA along the way, so I do like to sort of bring the business strategy side of things into how I approach technology and innovation. And with that, when I was at the smaller startups, you do a little bit of everything. So I've also sort of dabbled in strategy, finance, development, digital marketing, a little bit of everything. And I originally started my career in computer graphics. So I was doing both, sort of pure engineering work as well as artistic work in creating effects for both animated and live action movies. So I've had a bit of a varied career. Whatever I've been working on, the thread that I like to tie through it all is what I think of as a sense of magic. Whether it's a new consumer electronic good, whether it's a movie on the screen, what I really live for is the moment when someone's eyes get big and they say, "Whoa," or "That's awesome." That's what gets me up in the morning. And so I try to find that in whatever I'm doing.
Oh, amazing. And thinking about that kind of a finding that magic thread. And I think that's such a powerful way of kind of a framing what you do. Let's dive into your approach to tech-led innovation and finding that magic thread. I think that you're known for getting to the right answer and not necessarily getting to your answer. And I think that's quite a loaded thing in perhaps for any innovation team. I'm not sure if it's specific to engineering led innovation teams. But let me ask you, how do you make tech-led progress happen and getting to that, finding that magic thread?
So it's a good question. It really depends on the company that you're working for and the context that you're working within. For example, at Amazon, tech innovation is their DNA. So there you're really focusing on, just making a compelling business case. Here's why we should invest in this now. On the other hand, at the majority of companies that are not purely tech companies, it's harder. You really have to focus on how is this, this investment in technology, which will pull resources away from what the company actually does as their bread and butter, like, why is that the right thing to do? One of my former managers, who really taught me a lot about innovation, referred to tech innovation as existential risk management, which was really looking at sort of both sides, like, what are the 10x or 100x opportunities that if we don't take advantage of, someone else will? Or on the other hand, what are the tech developments that are going to fundamentally change the way we do business and put us out of business? And so those are obviously extreme examples, but that's really, it has to be framed in the business of what you're doing. And sort of start from there. Start from what are the problems that we're trying to solve as a company today? And then you focus on what within technology, within sort of my realm, can I do to advance that or to move things forward?
And how much of kind of the journey of innovation? Because I thought that it was a really interesting thing you just said around Amazon is engineering is at the core of their business, whereas other places that you've worked, like, I know you've kind of spent some time at Nike and other companies, like, that's technology innovation isn't the core of their business, but innovation in a thing is the core of the business, whether it's the running shoe. So it's like the innovation thread is in the business, just not necessarily from the technology perspective. And I wonder if how much of your role is bringing stakeholders into the journey and into those kind of realms of possibility. And it could be with anything from how does a retailer like Nike deal with the metaverse or blockchain? And I'm curious, do you think tech innovators should be really proactively briefing stakeholders around what's next, or I guess be told what to focus on from stakeholders? How do you navigate that balance?
It's definitely a hard balance. Again, I feel like I'm going to say this a lot today. It really depends on the company and the people you're working with. Some leaders are passionate about technology and they love having someone who can be their tech advisor, essentially, and say, tell me what's cool today. You know, like I've heard a lot about this technology, like tell me what it means. And so working with those leaders is always fun because you've got sort of a captive audience. In a lot of cases, you don't have that. And so then it's really starting from what's the pain point that they're feeling today. For someone who's not interested in tech for tech's sake, if you go to them and say, oh my God, the coolest thing was just presented at a conference, you're not going to have a lot of success. And so you have to either start from what they're experiencing today or where they see the world changing. Then you have to really tell the story of here's why that may not seem like a tech problem, but it is. Or here's why that may not be a problem that you would think to solve with tech, but we could actually do something that you're not even imagining right now. And so it does become, you know, to some extent, storytelling. When you're dealing with people who won't intuitively make those connections, a lot of times you really have to sort of set the groundwork so that they can see the same potential that you see.
And thinking about, I guess, the future and emerging tech, what are you excited about right now?
A lot of things. I think it's a really exciting time. I guess it's always an exciting time in tech. If I had to pick a few, I've worked for a lot of years in sort of whatever you want to call it these days, spatial computing, metaverse, AR, VR. And I do think that's an area that I'm still very, very excited about. The current devices on the market are fairly clunky and, you know, not certainly ready for all day use. But we are slowly converging on a future where everything you can currently do with those will be able to be computed by the eyeglasses that I've got on now. And when you get to that point, as much as I hate to say that anything's going to be the next iPhone because that's so overused, I mean, it really is as fundamental a change as going from, you know, a desktop computer to your mobile phone. Going from a mobile phone that has to sit in your pocket to, a pair of glasses that's just always on your face really will be a fundamental change. Slightly more near term, I'm really excited about robotics right now. I think that if you think about the last 18 months of AI from when ChatGPT first was made available and everyone was sort of like, oh my God, this is amazing. And you think of how things have progressed over, the subsequent year and a half. I think we're at a point right now where between sort of, the ability to run real-time simulations at almost real-world fidelity, the sort of fundamental robotic AI models that are existing right now, I think we're just about to hit that same point in robotics where if you look forward a year and a half, we'll think, oh my God, can you remember when, when we didn't have this, when this wasn't just a thing that existed in the world? So that's something that I'm really excited about over the near future.
Amazing. And do you think there's anything what do you think right now is really overhyped in the media? Because I'm curious around people that work in kind of a technology, engineering, and innovation, what they think is overhyped, and then conversely, what they're excited about that isn't picked up by the mainstream. I can probably guess your answer, but I'm going to ask the question anyway.
So I will say that right now, my gut reaction is AI for AI's sake. Every company right now is an AI company. And to me, that's, unless you're one of the, maybe 1% or 0.5% of companies who are doing truly sort of fundamental AI research, To me, at this point, AI is a tool that you use as an engineer. And so when a company says, oh, we use AI to do X, Y, and Z, I hear that as the same as a company saying, like, you should use our service because it's written in Golang. And I just say, okay, like, congratulations, you probably have some smart people. Like, what is it actually doing for me? And so that's one for me. You know, I think this one's probably, that's an easy answer. So I'll give you one that might be a little more contentious. I think existential risk of AI is overhyped right now. I think there are a lot of actual risks of how we're using AI and how we could start using AI that are worth paying a lot of attention to. I think fairness in AI, sort of how AI impacts the, you know, sort of like global majorities and, you know, different groups of people. I think those are very much worth focusing on. The, you know, like what happens when AGI transcends humanity. You know, a lot of people like to focus on that because it's science fiction. I think that gets a lot more attention right now than it should.
I think there's interesting debates like that are kind of cropping up right now around identity and ownership and copyright. So it's interesting when you see artists like FKA Twigs, like in front of the Senate talking about, I want a digital twin to essentially face into the media questions you get on a press tour when you release a record. I don't want to do that, but I want the choice to do it and the choice to sign it off. And then you have poor Scarlett Johansson, whose voice is just completely kind of like plagiarized without permission. So it's interesting how in this digital world, and I guess it crosses over with AI and the metaverse, around kind of identity and copyright and our kind of a digital selves, because right now we're only really used to our digital identities being what we put out into the digital world rather than, I guess, what's taken from us more in the form of an AI twin. So I think it's an interesting space, but I know in all the conference circuits this year, it's felt so overwhelming for me at least, and such a narrow focus. I think there's just so much else going on that we don't talk about as a result, because we've only got a certain amount of focus time. So that was interesting. So thank you for doing that for me. Okay, how engineering-led innovation works in reality. Talk to me about, is it important for you to have a portfolio of, say, innovation projects going on at different stages of the life cycle of a project? Is it important for you to have them going on at the same time?
Again, it depends. You know, there are a lot of times when, you know, you're in the midst of a really big initiative or a big project. And I think at, you know, in times like that, it can be a distraction. If you are constantly chasing the shiny object, you can have the risk of never doing anything to completion, and never being able to really tell a compelling story about anything. On the other hand, when you're in exploration mode, you don't want to put all of your eggs in one basket and say, this is the one technology, you know, that will rule them all. You really want to be, you know, doing a broad survey. You know, you need to obsess the problem and not the solution. And so, you know, if you can have a couple of problems you're trying to solve, but a variety of approaches that might solve them, that's sort of my sweet spot. I think if you have too many problems, you can't focus on them. If you have too few solutions, you tend to lose the ability to, you know, to sort of, you get too caught up with them being part of your personal identity, and it becomes harder to say, actually, this isn't a great idea.
That's really interesting. And I think it goes back to what we talked about in the beginning around actually loving the problem is that I think loving, like, finding the solution, not necessarily your answer to the problem. And the biases that we can sometimes bring with us. So thinking then about this, like having a portfolio and finding the right mix, which I guess is most people probably have to find that out the hard way. What's the sweet spot of projects at different sizes? I probably guess you only really learn it when it kind of goes wrong. But you hear a lot about failing fast. And I think that there's like quite a lot when you unpack that, because it's like concepts that teams have like dedicated loads of time and energy to doing. Like, it's a lot of stakeholder management, even probably to get it to a pilot stage. Talk to me about how you find the process of knowing when to stop and stopping a project And I say it in inverted commas, failing fast.
There's no easy answer. If there is, I certainly don't know it. So it's more a collection of things that can make it easier, I think. One is, and I sort of touched on this a second ago, creating an identity, not just a personal identity, but a team identity, an organizational identity that does not tie itself to successful outcomes. Or I guess it depends on the definition of successful outcomes. It does not tie itself to deployments. You know, it's really easy as an engineering team to say we're successful if the thing we built gets to a customer, and we've failed if it doesn't. And a lot of times that's how engineering teams are evaluated. That's how they're rewarded, especially companies that are not pure tech companies. You know, maybe your leaders only see the outcome if it's something that gets adopted across the company. And so it's really easy to fall into the trap of saying, you know, this has to be a success. If we turn it off now, we've wasted the last 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years. And so really, like, it starts from setting the expectations and the sort of organizational structure so that that's not an issue. And you can do that by celebrating stops. You know, like really celebrating internally, we stopped working on this project. Here's why. Here's what we learned. If you can turn that into a positive, it makes it a lot easier. I think on the other hand, it helps me personally. Different people have different ways of managing it. I find that I will rabbit hole and sort of, you know, chase a thread to its end. And so it helps me to set check-ins to say, you know, here's the next milestone. When we find the answer to this question, that's a new sort of diverging tree. Like, let's stop and evaluate then and say, does it still make sense to keep moving forward? And if you sort of set a little bit of structure in that way, it makes it a lot easier. Because then you're not just saying, this was a bad idea. It really becomes what's the continued value of pursuing it? And so really setting that structure up in advance, along with the sort of team structure that makes it okay for the answer to be, no, we shouldn't move forward. That's how I've sort of had the most success for myself. Like I said at the start, there's no good solution, or if there is, I'm not aware of it.
Talk to me about team dynamics and how important they are in innovation teams in particular, because this isn't business as usual. It's not operations. It's around, I guess, trying to kind of find a path to do something new. And how important are the kind of a team dynamics for like the resilience of people in the team, and also to allow them to be creative as well? I'm curious at what you might do to kind of foster this and foster good team dynamics and what that means for you.
At the lowest level, there are people who are comfortable with uncertainty and people who are not. And innovation is all about uncertainty. If you know the right answer to a problem, it's probably not innovation. It's just doing the thing you know you need to do. There are some people who just are fundamentally discomforted by the idea of, I don't know what the right answer to this problem is. And so those people tend to not enjoy innovation work much. So I think a lot of it is really, you know, starting with people being honest with themselves of, do I want to do innovation or do I just want to do interesting engineering work? Because there's a lot of really interesting engineering work that doesn't have to be innovation. So it starts with sort of the people you're working with. And then I think there are a lot of ways that you can either set yourself up for success or failure at a team level. I think having very rigid hierarchies with sort of top-down dictation doesn't foster that well, because that gets people into the mode of, I just do what I'm told. Like, you know, whether it's my VP or my direct manager or my lead, whoever it is, they told me, no, work on this thing, so I'm going to go work on that thing. That makes it really hard to innovate, because you're limiting yourself to one viewpoint. You really want to open yourself up so that anyone can suggest things, anyone can, challenge assumptions, anyone can have new ideas. But at the same time, you don't want the team to be going in every direction at once. So it really is a balance of how do you allow people to explore and to suggest new things, but at the same time, you know, have some sort of limitation on these are all great ideas. Let's focus on these couple first, and then, you know, explore the rest of these later when we have time or when we stop on one of those. And so, you know, it's a balance for sure. You know, I find that on innovation teams in particular, communication, empathy, you know, these things are more important than on sort of a typical engineering team, where you can get away with, you know, being someone who just wants to focus on what they're doing and not think about, you know, the other members of the team or something like that. You know, I think that really operating as, you know, a close-knit group where everyone values everyone else's perspective is sort of the table stakes for even being able to think about innovation.
You said something really interesting there about knowing yourself, and I guess I'm paraphrasing, but knowing what you're getting yourself in for at being part of an innovation team, because you can't kind of go down your rabbit hole. It's really about figuring out the future. But I guess a starting point for a lot of innovation and engineering projects, or really any projects, are often like brainstorming sessions and collaboration sessions, whether it might be within your team, it might be with other areas of your business. And so how does that work when it's so many different personality types? Because, and you're working with kind of a different teams in the business to kind of figure out what they need and how you can help. So I'm curious with kind of a, I guess, with your role today and your craft, what makes a good brainstorming session?
Ooh,
a creative session. If I want to use the word brainstorming now that I've said it out loud. That kind of a creative coming together sessions and workshops with all the different personality types, all the different roles, and really where you have an outcome that you need to get to.
You just touched on one of the most important things, which is having a clear outcome. Too many times I've been part of brainstorming sessions where it's just like, oh, we're going to get together and we're going to think about like what we could do. And then, you know, people will spend a day talking and they'll all come out of it and say, yeah, I'm just going to go back to what I was doing yesterday because that was a waste of my time. So really having a clear outcome, like what we are here for is to figure out X, Y, and Z, and sort of putting some structure in place around that. You know, I think another really important thing is not having a dominant personality or leader who's steering it. Whenever I can, I like to have somebody from outside entirely leading it. So I'll find some, you know, if I'm working with, you know, designers on how to, you know, make a new, you know, the new product for a company, maybe I'll have someone from a totally different part of the business who I've worked with in the past. And I'll say, hey, could you come facilitate this conversation? Because they come in with no expectations of the right answer. A lot of times, not really an understanding of the politics that might be present in the room. And so I think that's really helpful because it keeps, you know, having a few people who from steering the conversation. And that's, you know, if it's brainstorming within my team and I'm leading the conversation, everyone naturally will defer to what I say. And so then there are times when I have to do that. And then as the person who's steering it, I have to be very, very careful to not put my opinions into the conversation. And so, you know, that's a lot of it. And I mean, the last thing I'll say is just really getting different perspectives and different types of people into the room. You know, if all you have are engineers and you're brainstorming about a business problem, you're going to solve it with engineering. But if you can get, you know, some engineers and some marketers and some salespeople and all of them into a room, you hear different perspectives and you know, the engineers all of a sudden can say, oh, hold on a second. Like, I didn't even realize that's the problem you're facing. We can help with that. Or, you know, the salespeople saying, wait, you could do that in tech? Like, that would make my life so much easier. And so, you know, really having the variety of perspectives, I think, is necessary. But then, you know, that complicates things because you have to make sure that people don't talk past each other, make sure everyone's, you know, means the same thing when they're using shared language. So it's more of a challenge, but you'll get much better outcomes if you can manage it.
Awesome. I think there's some top tips there, especially bringing in an external facilitator who knows nothing of the politics or really the subject. So they can just kind of ask all the kind of questions that maybe perhaps other people don't want to.
And honestly, there's a certain power to being able to say, to being able to play dumb, essentially, in these meetings, to say, oh, I don't understand the context here. What about this? Like, it sounds like this person was saying that. What do you think here? And being able to ask the questions that might seem silly to everyone else in the room, there's a certain power to that as the person facilitating it.
Again, another top tip. Talk to me, Aaron, about engineering innovation projects when they go well. So what are you really proud of that you've worked on?
Ooh, things that I'm proud of that I've worked on. So early in my career, I mentioned I started in computer graphics. I remember the first movie I worked on was a live action Peter Pan that sort of came and went in 2003 or four, maybe. But I had been a musical theater kid in high school. I remember being home. I grew up in Hawaii on Kauai, which is sort of a smaller community. I remember being home for Christmas, going to a movie theater, and waiting through the credits until my name came up on the big screen. Being there with a group of friends, people were cheering. That was sort of like one of those moments that I still have that clear memory of that moment in time. It's been sort of variations on that. Like I mentioned at the top, the oh wow moments. There were moments when I was working at Magic Leap where, you know, we created a particular piece of content that people would view, and then they'd take the headset off and they'd have tears in their eyes because it was so sort of emotionally impactful. Those were also moments where I was just like, okay, we've done something here that connects with people. So incredibly proud of those moments. That's sort of, I could go sort of step by step through my career. Everything's had moments like that of something that, is possible today that's not possible, that wasn't possible yesterday. And those are really the moments that stick out to me.
Talk to me about when kind of engineering innovation goes wrong. So in my world, when we talk a lot about kind of a change and making progress happen, sometimes it's not necessarily like the kind of say, for example, if it's a pilot, it's not the technology that's not working, it's the way people's adoption of it is, or there's like a lack of understanding. So I think there's like loads of pitfalls, at least in my view of the world, of where kind of a innovation with the best intentions kind of goes wrong. And so I was just curious to your experience, and you've worked at some amazing companies, both kind of a very kind of engineering led as well as like product led companies. How closely do you work with change managers? And then, because really what I'm interested in is the advice that you have for, say, people stepping into kind of an engineering led kind of innovation roles who want to make progress happen. Like, what are some pitfalls that they can avoid? And do you have any advice for, when it doesn't, I was going to say not go to plan, or it just, it doesn't land where you want it to, and not in a good way.
You sort of touched on it, but the hardest part of innovation is that you have to work with people. If you're actually doing meaningful innovation, someone's going to be unhappy with what you're doing. You're forcing someone to change the way they do the job they've done for 10 years, or you're automating people's jobs away entirely, or you're, making a vendor unnecessary. In any of those cases, you're going to have someone who's pushing back against you. And as the engineer, if you come to the room and say, you should do this because it's the, it's the best engineering solution, you're going to have problems. It's not going to work the way you want it to. Sort of human nature is that people will say, who's this Aaron guy? And like, who does he think he is to tell me how to do my job? And once you've gotten to that point, the door is closed. And it's really hard to open that door again. So like you said, you need sort of you can call them change managers. You need advocates. And that can be you know, sometimes the way you approach it is you find that early adopter, the really tech forward person who you can work with, who's really excited to try something new. And so, and then they can try it and they can say to their colleagues, oh my God, you gotta try this. Like, it seems weird, but give it a shot. Like, after a week, you will really understand it. And that's really, you know, then it's one of their peers telling them. So, you know, it's someone who they respect. So it's sort of a trusted advisor. And then on the other hand, you could have, you know, your change manager can be leadership. And a lot of times you see this with cost reductions, where you can get a senior leader to just say, look, this is the way it is now. Like, this is going to reduce our costs by 50%. We've got to do it. So we're going to do it. And that's, you know, that's a harder one to feel good about at the end of the day. But you've got to approach it one way or the other. You've got to either have someone who's convincing them to try something new or someone who's forcing them to try something new. It's very rare that you can have a tech advancement that is so universally beloved that, you know, that people will want to change the way they work to adopt it of sort of their own volition.
Amazing. Aaron, I think it's time to move to some quick fire questions.
All right.
What was your last impulse buy?
I'm overdue for one. I've been thinking about a couple of them. The last one I bought was probably a SodaStream, which is it's a carbonator for beverages, essentially. My family was spending way too much money on canned carbonated water. And so that was one where it's like, all of a sudden, we can do it ourselves in the house. And the kids love it. And it has saved a lot of money over its lifetime so far.
That's amazing. And I'm now intrigued about the weirdest thing that you can carbonate.
we're pretty boring when it comes to carbonation.
Tell me, what stresses you out the most?
Let's see. Well, in a work context, when I have to work on something that does not matter to the business. A lot of times you have sort of mandates from the top down that just are irrelevant, but it's someone's pet project, or it's, you know, for whatever reason, you have to do it and it just doesn't matter. For me personally, it just grates on me. Outside of that, it's probably, you know, I've got two kids, and so I spend a lot of time juggling after school transportation with work meetings, with everything else, which is a very different kind of stress.
Tell me, what was the best piece of kind of a work advice you've ever been given?
So this was actually back before I decided to get my MBA. I was trying to decide, you know, I had been an engineer, I wasn't sure, and I talked to the president of, I guess at the time it was called Sony Pictures Digital. I was working at Sony Pictures. And he had an MBA. So I said, you know, like, I want to pick your brain on it. And the advice he gave me about getting an MBA was, there's almost no job you'll ever have that requires an MBA. But almost any job you will ever have, you'll do it better for having gotten an MBA. And that was sort of, it changed the way I was thinking about it. And I found it to be true over my career that, you know, in engineering jobs as an individual contributor, as a manager, as an innovator, being able to really think from a holistic business standpoint has made me better at pretty much every job I've done since then.
Last question. On a scale of 1 to 10, Aaron Wilson, how weird are you?
Ooh, that's a tough one. How weird am I? I would say probably a 7 or 8, but because I'm an introvert, I probably present as more of a 3 or 4 because I keep it all inside.
This has been such a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much for your time, Aaron.
Thanks for chatting with me. It's been fun.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe, and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.